I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. It's estimated that there are 40 to 50,000 elephants living in Asia and between 400 and 500,000 elephants in Africa. And if something isn't done to stop the threats they face from poachers, deforestation, climate change, urbanization, war, and conflict, we will all live in a world without elephants, or live in a world where elephants will only be found in zoos. And while Asian and African elephants are the same species, they live different lives. In Asia, 25 to 30% of elephants are employed, engaged in logging and hauling goods and people. Our guest, Jacob Schell, Associate Professor of Geography and Urban Studies at Temple University, has a new book. It's called Giants of the Monsoon Forest, and it's about the teak loggers who live in the forests of Myanmar, Burma, and in India, and their complicated working relationship with elephants. Jacob Schell joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. And joining us from the studios of Princeton University to talk about African elephants is Andrew Dobson. He's a professor of ecology at Princeton who studies infectious diseases and the conservation of endangered and threatened species, including elephants. And Andrew Dobson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Always great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And they do join us to discuss the intelligence and social worlds of these extraordinary animals, the largest land animals, and what can be done to ensure their survival. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Andrew Dobson, let me begin with you, and I just want to talk for a bit about what we know about elephant intelligence. And I wonder, what's the best way to understand that, the best way to describe the unique intelligence that this animal has?
Well, can we just kick off with a correction? In fact, there are the Indian elephants and the African elephants are two different species. And in fact, there are two species of African elephants, the forest elephants and the savanna elephants. And then there's also the Indian elephants. And those three species split apart probably 2 to 4 million years ago. So they are, although very, very similar, once you get your eye in looking at them, all three species have distinct shapes.
Fair now enough. And I appreciate the correction. I'm clearly not an elephant scientist here.
Okay. And they're all listed differently under CITES as three different species for protection.
Gotcha.
So that, of course, brings down the numbers because there are many less of them once you divide them up into different species. All of them have the characteristic of living a long time. And if you live a long time, that's a great recipe to develop your brain because you've got to remember things that have happened in the past. The environment you're living in changes from year to year. So having a memory for where water was in times of drought from 10, 20 years ago is a really valuable resource. Similarly, because they live in large social systems, remembering who everybody is who you interact with, which is a problem for many of us, is an equal problem for elephants, and lots of their brain goes into that, and lots of their brain development is driven by that.
In general,
the larger social groups you live in as species, the larger your brain will be, particularly as you live longer.
Could we say that elephants are self-aware? They have a sense of their self?
And that's an interesting question. To do that, people have tried to look at that with different species of primates, monkeys, and to get at self-awareness, you have to start doing things with mirrors, and right. Doing things with mirrors and elephants would be quite tricky. They certainly know who each other are, so you would think through that they have a pretty good indication of who they are.
You know, I've seen, and I'm sure a lot of people have seen, you know, frankly, on YouTube, where you see a baby elephant. I've seen this several times. A baby elephant is stuck in a ditch somewhere, and you see all the other elephants that are there coming and essentially helping this baby out of this ditch. What does that tell us, Andrew, about elephants?
Well, elephants live in matriarchal societies. All the female elephants are related to each other in a group of elephants. You're with your grandmother, your great-grandmother, your aunts. The larger the size of the group, the more babies are born at the same time. So it's the same as with you. If you go with your mothers and your aunts to the playground and have an accident, they all cluster around to help rescue you. If a baby elephant gets caught in a ditch, its mum will come back, but it's likely that its aunts and perhaps its grandmother or even its great-grandmother will come back to help.
So are we talking about a matriarchal society?
totally matriarchal society. If you are a female elephant, you live with all of your female relatives for all of your life, the two or three generations above you, and as you get older, two or three generations below you.
Let me get you in on the conversation, Jacob. And your book is about this unique relationship, I would say, between these teak loggers in Burma / Myanmar, also in India. Help us understand from your perspective how we should understand the Asian elephant.
For the book, I did about 7 years of field work. These are short trips staggered over 7 years, not 7 years in a row, in the sort of border region of India and Burma or Myanmar. And in that area, there's about 8,000 or 9,000 Asian elephants engaged in doing forms of labor on behalf of forest-based human communities. So that means logging, especially logging of teak, for a variety of reasons. This is especially relevant to teak, and also cross-forest transportation in areas where there are few roads that can facilitate transportation, and also flood season or monsoon season transportation. Asian elephants are incredibly useful and dexterous at doing all of these different things. So the overall number of elephants that have the sort of domestic relationship with human beings out of the 40 to 50,000 that you alluded to in the introduction, it's probably something like 15,000. So we're talking about a bit more than half are engaged in this kind of labor. And the remainder who have some sort of domestic relationship with humans are probably in tourist parks, giving rides to tourists, or maybe they're in zoos, or maybe they're part of religious organizations and marching in religious festivals and things like this. And so what's especially significant about the 8,000 or 9,000 elephants that drew my interest and who are doing this particular kind of forest-based labor for humans is that they're released into the forest every single night. And so what that means is that unlike zoo elephants or elephants stuck in tourist compounds, they're able to seek out mates in the forest on their own terms. And in the case of Asian elephants, and I think this is probably true of African elephants as well, this tends to really help to facilitate higher reproduction rates. Elephants are relatively stubborn maters when they're in sort of human micromanaged environments, which to me, it's not sort of my area of expertise to figure out to measure how intelligent they are, but to me that speaks of a certain kind of sensitivity to the general situation they find themselves in.
Andrew, let me go back to you, and then I'll go back to you, Jacob. Are there, when you look at the relationship between African elephants, the two species of African elephants, and people living in countries in Africa, do we see a working relationship the way Jacob just described?
No, we tend not to see that. It's proved culturally people haven't tried to domesticate African elephants, neither the forest ones nor the savanna ones. They're bigger than the Indian elephants, so that sort of makes them harder to domesticate. They tend not to have that relationship with them.
Let me go back to you, Jacob, and let's talk about this domestication process. And I'll have you describe it, and I'll say to our listeners reading his book, some of it is frankly deeply disturbing to read about what it takes to, quote unquote, domesticate these elephants. But help us understand how this works.
Sure. Well, some people take issue with the word domesticate because they hear that word and they think that it means selectively bred, like has happened with domestic dogs or domestic cattle or horses. And what's really fascinating about Asian work elephants is that they haven't been selectively bred to do these particular complex tasks, sometimes very high urgency tasks like rescues of humans stranded during floods and things like this. They haven't been selectively bred to do these things. But to get to your question involving the training or domestication or taming process, it does depend on the area and the particular situation of the elephant. Some of these elephants are captured out of the wild, which can be through what's called a stockade method, where they sort of on-site stockades. Yeah, sort of corralled. They're sort of corralled in the middle of the forest. More typical, there's a lassoing method which happens. That's called mela shekar, at least on the Indian side of the border. That's the term it usually goes under. And this can sometimes be a rather violent process, though the whole idea, of course, is to capture a healthy elephant that at least is sort of psychologically in good enough shape that it can then become a reliable work partner for the humans that are going to be working with it for the rest of its life. The training process can sometimes be pretty brutal to hear about or see firsthand. This is a process for elephants that would be captured out of the wild, and especially in the ethnic minority upland areas. This would not be as true in sort of southern Burma and the more government-managed areas. But in these upland areas, the taming process can involve a young elephant being tied up all four limbs to four different tree posts and then left there for many months in a row, with humans coming back on a daily basis to give it treats or to sing lullabies, some of which I heard sort of sung to me in a different environment or sort of interesting to hear. But it is the way in which that particular elephant would be psychologically severed from life as it's known it thus far would tend to be a pretty brutal intervention into that elephant's life. So that's a reality that I try to take very seriously in the book, while also trying to see some important benefit in these relationships as well.
When you talk to the people who were doing this kind of domesticating of these elephants, how did they describe, how did they see what they did? Did they see that as a form of abuse or even torture?
They wouldn't use terms like abuse and torture. They at first, I'm thinking in particular of a group of people that I don't actually want to say what side of the Indian-Burmese border it was on, because they were hesitant to even speak to me. I mean, they were very worried that various kinds of government regulations or international kinds of animal welfare groups could be very upset by what they're doing or seek to penalize them for what they're doing. So certainly there's an awareness that they're doing something that many other human beings out there would not approve of. But terms like abuse, torture would not be something they'd use. I found that the way in which, like in some of the songs that they sing to the elephants and to each other, once I sort of had these songs, which are in various sort of obscure upland languages, translated by guides I had in this region, I found that some of these songs really do communicate a very kind of emotionally conflicted relationship to the kind of work they're doing. They feel that they're taking something out of the forest and aspects of their spiritual practices. Many of these people are animist, sort of signal that there's a strongly felt need to sort of give something back in some way. So it is very complicated from their point of view.
I do want to pick up on that. I'm sure, Andrew Dobson, you want to weigh in on that as well. We are talking about elephants in this hour of Radio Times. The voice you just heard is Jacob Schell. He's an associate professor of geography and urban studies at Temple University here in Philadelphia. And he's got a new book, it's called Giants of the Monsoon Forest, Living and Working with Elephants. Andrew Dobson joining us from the studios of Princeton University to talk about the elephants of Africa. He's a professor of ecology, studies infectious diseases, the conservation of endangered and threatened species. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is
supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with our guests Andrew Dobson and Jacob Schell about the intelligence and social worlds of elephants, the largest land animal. What can be done to ensure their survival? Andrew, let me go to you. And based on what you heard Jacob Schell describe about how these elephants in Asia are domesticated, what is your response to that?
Well, it's very easy and wrong to criticize the behavior of other cultures. The thing I find fascinating is this singing to animals while you're being cruel to them. The Maasai, who I work with in Tanzania, whenever they're slaughtering a goat, they always bring it with them. They sit down, someone holds it very gently, and they sing to it. And while they're singing to it, they gently cut its throat. And I think the description of what they're doing to that elephant is the mental equivalent. They're essentially cutting off its mental links with the society it grew off in a way that sort of kills it as part of that society. So I find it cruel, but again, criticizing other people's cultures is a very thin area of ice to be wandering onto.
And I completely agree with you. And I say all this knowing that I do not interact with elephants. I mean, they're not a part of my life. I don't, you know, use them in any way. And I think obviously most of us living in most of the world, we do not deal with elephants on a daily basis the way people in countries in Africa and countries in Asia do. Andrew?
That's certainly true. And there's sort of two sides to that. There are lots of areas elephants are coming in and raiding people's crops, largely because the areas available to elephants have been reduced and people start building their farms, little farms called bomas, around the edge of protected areas. Ironically, largely because the protected areas are really good sources of water. The elephants can smell those crops growing, so they think, well, let's go and eat these. They don't make any judgment about whether it's their food or not. All food is your food if you're an elephant. And having your whole year's crops eaten by an elephant is going to be really annoying for you, particularly if when you go and try and chase that elephant away, it comes and chases you. So these conflicts between elephants and humans is something we've got. We're getting better at looking at novel ways to resolve. And that's got to be done if elephants persist. They're likely mainly to persist in large nature reserves, but we've got to organize those and manage them in ways that minimizes potential conflict with people living around the edge and also maximally minimizes the poaching efforts of people trying to kill elephants for their ivory.
And Andrew, for a typical elephant, how many miles do they roam on a, you know, sort of typical year, even month?
Well, elephants we know can move large distances. Usually they're quite happy being in the same area. How far they go is very much dependent on rainfall. If you have the elephants that live in the deserts in Namibia, they will range over large areas because essentially the amount of food available to you is rainfall times soil quality. If you're in the forest elephants may be over relatively restricted areas because it's raining most of the year there. The plants are growing all the time and they're completely surrounded by plants to eat.
Let me go back to you, Jacob. And you mentioned the fact that these elephants you were describing at night are set loose. They are on a chain, but the chain is maybe, what, a mile long at night?
Oh, no, that's not quite the arrangement. There is a chain. It's a very loosely attached chain connecting the two forelegs to each other. So not to a post, not to a tree. They have total sort of spatially free mobility in the forest to find food. They might sleep since it's nighttime, and most crucially, to mate with other elephants that they find. So it's not that they're wandering around chained to some post or something like that. So it's very important in this region that these elephants are present, because from what I gather, at least from interviews that I conducted, just people sort of understanding of the local wild elephants, those wild elephant herds do tend to like to annually migrate at the scale of maybe several hundred miles.
Wow.
And it does have to do with when and where the rainfall is happening and where things are wet versus dry, high versus low, and these kinds of factors. But what's happened is that as deforestation in these regions has happened, as it's happened virtually everywhere in the world over the past several centuries, is that these forest corridors have become broken up. And so wild herds have become isolated from each other, which can create all sorts of problems, as Andrew was talking about, with elephants trying to encroach upon newly introduced farmland, and that creates conflicts between farmers and elephants. And also, as herds become broken up, there's less genetic transfer between those herds. And again, there's only 40,000 Asian elephants left, so it's really essential that there be some kind of genetic transfer and diversification within the species. So if you have these domesticated elephants who are actually sort of being protected, and maybe their mobility is actually sort of stewarded by humans who are invested in protecting them, sometimes actually being moved from pocket of forest to pocket of forest, they can actually act as sort of genetic bridges from these isolated pockets of for us to from one to the other.
In fact, you say, or you write in the book, that the rate of reproduction, the fact that they have this freedom at night, has resulted in higher rates of births, certainly compared to things like zoos.
Yes, and that's actually based on studies which some elephant biologists that I've been in touch with and become close with over the last few years have done, using more sort of laboratory-driven scientific and data-driven analysis. Not really the kind of thing that I personally do, which is more fieldwork-based, interviews, some historical research and things like that. So the studies seem to kind of reproduce and get to the same results. So I sort of trust them, but that is the outcome that they've arrived at.
Does that make sense to you, Andrew?
Well, to some extent, it makes sense. We know from the sort of classic long-term studies of African elephants that have been done at Amboseli in Kenya and Tarangire in Tanzania that the annual birth rate of elephants goes up and down with what's the rainfall been like over the last 48 months. And then that is then modified by the density of elephants. If elephants get up to a high density, then there's less food to go around, so their reproductive rate declines. The sort of time between births lengthens a little. Particularly the age at which they first reproduce gets later if they're at very high density or if they're in a really sort of dry area. Hmm. So there are environmental constraints on breeding. The other thing is that the females are very choosy. Once a female elephant has mated with an older male elephant, she will never mate with a younger male elephant. And so females avoid young male elephants because an elephant's quite a big, clumsy thing, and the sort of elephant equivalent of a teenage boy is not something you want to mess around with.
So fascinating. Is climate change, though, you talk about the importance of habitat and things like water, is climate change affecting elephant behavior?
That's an interesting question. I really don't think we've got enough data yet to be able to tell that. I mean, the key thing with climate change is it's having its biggest effects in the Arctic. The places it's going to have its latest and slowest effects is as we get towards the equator. So we have to understand climate change. We really have to look at the Arctic and then the temperate regions to get any prediction about what's going to happen in the tropics. The biggest worry there is, will there be any tropics left for climate change to have an effect in 25, 30 years' time?
We'll let that question hang out there. That's Andrew Dobson. He's a professor of ecology. He studies infectious diseases and the conservation of endangered and threatened species. He's joining us from the studios of Princeton University. And also with us, Jacob Schell. He's here with us in Philadelphia, the WHYY studios, associate professor of geography and urban studies at Temple University. And he spent a fair amount of time in East Asia looking at elephants and their relationship with loggers. And he's got a new book called Giants of the Monsoon Forest. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Cecilia left a comment on our Facebook page last night. Elephants are the most amazing, brilliant creatures. I hope your show delivers that message to your listeners. Jacob, let me go back to you. One of the things that you say in this book, and if we're talking about the survival of elephants, we have to be creative, it seems, and sort of understand that the world that we live in. But you seem to be saying, or you are saying, that this relationship between these, in a sense, working elephants and these people who live in Myanmar, Burma, India, that might be a model looking forward, this working relationship.
Yes, that's ultimately the kind of argument or maybe like proposal that the book winds up kind of arriving at by its last few chapters. If you look at these elephants that I was interested in, some of them are engaged in logging work, which I think has some promise, like sustainable logging as a way of trying to conserve elephants. But on the other hand, if what the elephants are dependent upon is conservation of the forest itself, and I argue that it definitely is, then it seems like trying to attach elephants' long-term prospects to logging, that seems to sort of, even if it's sustainable logging, that seems to conflict against the agenda of trying to conserve and maybe even re-expand the territory of the forest. Some of the other elephants are engaged in sort of secret transportation through the forest. So the Kachin Independence Army in the far north of Burma, which is engaged in one of the world's longest-running civil wars against the central Burmese government, actually has a transportation brigade of about 50 or 60 elephants that move things in secret across the forest. Which
goods and people, I guess?
Passengers, sometimes weapons, sometimes things like food and medicine, clean drinking water and things like that. This completely fascinated me, and I ran a bunch of interviews in that region with people who are knowledgeable about those practices. But that's also a sort of similar example where it's not like I would want that civil war to go on and on forever as a strategy of saving the Asian elephant species. That would be a sort of absurd thing to argue. So what I ultimately really hone in the book is the fact that a lot of these elephants become uniquely useful for transportation during the flood season. And the flood season in this region is very intense. I think at least in certain pockets, it's that has the most intense monsoon precipitation in the world. And it basically negates what little sort of forest network actually exists. Wheeled motor vehicles, even heavy-duty all-terrain vehicles, have a lot of trouble getting across this landscape due to things like felled trees from storms, mudslides, wow. just the intense mud, sort of this glutinous, sticky mud that kind of exists everywhere at that time of year. Whereas the Asian elephants have a relatively easy go of it and are also able to carry people and cargo on their backs. And so I visited some villages, in particular on the Indian side of the border, which actually have a kind of elephant ford, which exists to get across their local rivers during the monsoon season. So they build these dry season bridges that sort of wash away when the monsoon floods come, and then the elephants are the main way back and forth across the river. So this kind of, and these are elephants again who are released into the forest every night where they can mate with other elephants that they encounter there. So this is the kind of thing that I thought potentially holds a huge amount of promise for potentially re-expanding the numbers in that species.
Andrew, let me go back to you and let's talk more about the elephants of Africa and the threats that they face from both poachers, but also obviously the ivory trade. How big a threat is that today?
Well, the ivory trade fluctuates up and down very much as the price of ivory goes up and down. Very nice recent paper in Science by some colleagues of mine from York University, Colin Beale and his colleagues, have shown how sensitive the levels of poaching are to the prices of ivory. That seems to have gone down a little bit at the moment, largely due to lots of education of people in China in particular, but also in the US. Those are the two big markets for ivory. If you can persuade people not to buy ivory, the price of ivory goes down and the levels of poaching go down. But it doesn't go away because sooner or later somebody decides that ivory is valuable for things, or the market expands again because other things have got commoner and people want rare things and ivory is always a rare thing. So the price goes up and the poaching starts again. So we have to be vigilant at both ends, attacking the market, arresting the people who are the main big dealers in ivory and pulling them away for a long time, but also being vigilant on the ground and having anti-poaching patrols and mechanisms to make sure that the poaching doesn't start up again.
And is poaching, is it illegal? Is it considered illegal?
Totally.
I mean, I'm just making sure so our listeners...
Well, poaching is illegal. There are still idiots who go out and hunt elephants, which is arguably one of the most stupid things you can do.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I was reading that Botswana is bringing back elephant hunting.
It strikes me as a totally unethical thing to do. Most of the animals that they are trying to hunt have probably been sort of trapped to go into areas where it's easier for the hunters to find them. Often they're animals that are used to seeing tourist vehicles. People will, I mean, it's not as if it's the traditional Hemingway walking along the ground looking for animals. These are people often just going out in cars and shooting them from cars. And that's not really hunting. These are people who would themselves be better off in a fun fair trying to shoot ducks off a fountain.
In a place like Botswana, if we're talking about elephant hunting, is it for the tusks or is it for the so-called thrills of taking down such a large animal?
Well, it's this pathetic thrill of shooting it from a vehicle. I don't see why there's anything thrilling about that.
Why do you think Botswana brought it back? And I was reading there's something like 130,000 elephants in Botswana.
Well, Botswana does seem to have the largest concentration of elephants left in Africa. That's partly because Botswana is very wealthy for other reasons. It is particularly wealthy in diamonds. So lots of the Botswanan economy comes from the diamond and rare element industry. So people can get jobs in that and don't have to live on the sort of poverty level on little sort of farms out in the countryside.
Christine had a question about hunting, but she also asked, what would be considered healthy numbers for each of the three populations of elephants? Do we know the answer to that, Andrew? Like, you know, how many elephants should there be in order to be able to be sustained by the environment, for instance?
Well, we probably, in Africa, probably have of the order of 2 to 5% of the elephants we had in 1800. So, yeah, if you wanted to go back to that level, yeah, you would be looking at 20 million or so.
Okay.
That's never going to happen because lots of the areas where the elephants used to live are now completely overrun by humans and agriculture. The figures you give, that 400 to 500,000, I think is very optimistic. And I think it could be closer to 250,000. And I think really healthy is not the best word to think of, but I think it would be more comforting if we knew there were of the order of 2 million elephants.
Okay. And would that be in Africa?
In Africa. And that would be both savanna and forest elephants. And probably you might get up to 500,000 forest elephants if you can protect the Central African forests. But just as the Brazilian forest is massively under threat, so is the Central African forest.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about elephants in this hour of Radio Times, the world's largest land animal, talking about their intelligence. We've been talking about their social worlds as well and some of the threats that they face and some of the ideas related to conservation. Our guests are Andrew Dobson and Jacob Schell. We want you to join our conversation. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments about elephants? Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Time.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Here on WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we are all learning a lot about elephants, their intelligence, their rich social lives, their use of tools, their range of emotions. And again, our guests are Jacob Schell, Associate Professor of Geography and Urban Studies at Temple University, author of a new book called Giants of the Monsoon Forest, and Andrew Dobson with us as well. He's a professor of ecology at Princeton University. He studies infectious diseases and the conservation of endangered and threatened species. Let me read an email from Marsha. She says, on a trip to India several years ago, we asked to go to a, quote, elephant sanctuary. Tourists could pay to feed them, put paint on them, and ride them. When we left, we saw several chained in tiny cinder block cells. It felt like we had participated in enslaving elephants. What should tourists be aware of? Jacob, let me put that to you only because it was in India where she saw this. Your thoughts about elephant, I guess, tourism or elephant sanctuaries?
Sure. And just before I dive into answering that, let me just circle back to, we had been talking about ivory poaching before. And ivory poaching is definitely a huge issue. I think probably much more of a pertinent threat to African elephants as compared with Asian elephants, to whom definitely the number one threat to the species is deforestation, which is something distinct from ivory poaching.
Sure.
So that's a sort of a point which I think sometimes gets lost in the mix with Western attitudes towards the issue of elephant conservation that I wanted to reemphasize. But to get to the listener's question
the
about
elephant
sanctuaries. Yeah. I mean, there's some, again, similar to anti-poaching efforts, there's people who are involved in setting up and running elephant sanctuary who are doing really heroic work And so certainly my intent is not to poo-poo or dismiss the kind of work that some of these elephant parks or sanctuaries are doing. And some tourist parks are actually excellent and keep things at a very high level of quality in terms of elephant welfare, access to good food, clean water, good exercise each day in some sort of forest-like adjacent environment, things of, along those lines. It sounds like the sanctuary that the listener visited was not an example of one of the good ones. So certainly I'm not in any way in favor of the bad ones. I think that there's a lot to be said for some of the good ones. But even the good ones have this fundamental problem where they can't really give their elephants open, unencumbered access to the forest on a nightly basis in the way that the transportation and logging elephants that are more connected to these human forest cultures are able to do. So this is sort of my critique of the elephant tourism industry, even when really well managed, which is something I would advocate for, but even when it's really well managed, it can't really function as a totally workable conservation model. So that would be my sort of view of the matter.
Andrew, what are your thoughts about these elephant sanctuaries? Or perhaps I remember going to Africa in the 1960s when I was a little girl, and you know, spending several weeks in the Serengeti and the Mara in East Africa, where you have done a lot of your work. When you look at places where elephants are protected, what do they need? And do you have thoughts about elephant sanctuaries?
I'm always very nervous about these elephant sanctuaries where people have got them tied up. They're letting you get close to the elephants and, you know, perhaps riding around on them. The background cruelty that you don't always see unless you sort of look a bit behind the scenes is often horrifying. Oh. And that when you see those elephants, you can just, once you're used to looking at healthy elephants, say in Africa or even in parts of India, such as Kasaranga, where you can see them, you can tell that these are elephants that are psychologically very stressed.
In what way? How would one recognize that?
Just a sort of, you know, it's the way their heads are hanging, the way they're not really interacting with the other elephants, that they've completely had the spirit knocked out of them. I mean, to me, the best type of elephant tourism is if you go to Amboseli, where Cynthia Moss and Joyce Poole have worked for a long time with those elephants. Those elephants are used to being around tourist cars, so you can sit there very quietly and watch the elephants interact with each other. And when you see all the stuff that's going on, it's better than a soap opera. It's really exciting to sit and watch them in action. You can increasingly see that in Serengeti as well. The behavior of those animals when they're lively like that is night and day different from these elephants that have tried to be domesticated and have been put in these sanctuaries where they're not really behaving like natural elephants.
And you're saying because humans, in a sense, keep their distance and get to observe rather than washing the baby elephants and all the things you can do.
Letting the elephants come to you so as they're relaxed is the best way to see them.
Oh, fascinating. A call from Jeff who says, I've been to Botswana twice and the reason people are hunting them again is that they are overpopulated now. Andrew, do you think that's true?
Well, inner cities are pretty overpopulated with humans. Do you think we should allow hunting in there? I mean, what's Jeff's definition and qualification to say what overpopulation is? You know, I've worked as an ecologist for 40 years. Defining what overpopulation is something that requires a lot of scientific training, and there are almost no overpopulations of anything on this planet at the moment.
How should we then, I'll put this first to you, Andrew, and then to you, Jacob, then how do you suggest we coexist with elephants, knowing that their needs and our needs can come in conflict? Andrew?
As I say, we've got to realize that there are parts of the planet that are going to have to be occupied by all the other species other than humans. And some parts of the planet, which will be occupied by humans, and they maybe will go and visit those places. But we've got to organize that quite quickly and quite sharply because the quality of human life is very, very dependent on having large wild areas, particularly to supply us with water. And having wild animals living in those areas and those areas working as the large natural ecosystems that they evolved to be is the only way we're going to have sustainable water, clean air, and a viable planet that slows down climate change.
Go ahead.
And we've got to do those kids on the streets in Europe know much more about this than the politicians. We've got to get this done in the next 20 years or we're sunk.
just to underscore what you're saying there, in the next 20 years, what do we have to do, Andrew?
We have to completely reorganize the way we manage the planet. We're not just going to protect elephants. We've got to protect as much of the natural habitat as is left as is possible and start restoring it.
And can we say that if the elephants go, we're going to go behind them?
Yeah. I mean, it's really dumb to think, oh, humans will be the last species to go extinct. Even if you were betting on it, humans would be halfway down the list. And we might be a long way earlier than that.
Jacob, let me get you to weigh in. And again, from this perspective, from your work in Myanmar, Burma, India.
Yeah, well, I think we definitely need we need to conserve what little forests is left. We need to hopefully re-expand the range of the forest. But I think it's very difficult to say from the vantage point of, say, the northeast of the United States or Western Europe or what have you, you people in India or China or Thailand or Burma, Myanmar or what have you, whereas we took our most kind of valuable river valleys and converted them into intensive urbanized corridors and agricultural corridors, and that's what New England and Western Europe is sort of like now, you need to do something completely different where you maintain the forest. And I think that that's a difficult, just in sort of like a, at a geopolitical level, that's a very difficult argument to put forward. And so one of the things that I was really interested in was the fact that in this particular region, this is sort of the border area of India and Burma, why does what little forest that remains still remain? Now, in some areas, this is because it's sort of mountainous, and so it's not great for agriculture. But in a lot of these areas, it actually is really potentially lucrative for agriculture, for certain staple crops like sugar, palm plantations, potatoes, rice, things like this. And so the fact that those kinds of forces of development haven't penetrated these forest areas yet has a lot to do with the fact that the human communities that are living there have found other ways to derive livelihood from the territory that allow the forest cover to remain in place. And these could be things, it could be things like sustainable mining, sustainable logging, cross-forest transportation, hunting to some extent, though that there's like a limit on how much wealth that can actually facilitate. So I think even with the question of hunting, which you were talking about before, I tend to sort of come at those kinds of issues from a different point of view that says, well, if these particular cultures are able to do what they're doing in a way that keeps the forest in place, there's a huge amount of potential there for figuring out how this very crowded part of the planet is going to have two large mammal species, elephants and humans, one obviously being much bigger, coexisting in the same space.
But you're saying that this works because of the kind of sustainable practices that you observed, but also because of elephants.
Some of these cultures, like the hunting cultures, tend to actually be less elephant-oriented in terms of exploiting elephant labor. But some of these other groups, yes, they're depending upon the elephants in order to facilitate transportation and mobility across the forest. And so if you remove the elephants from the picture, many of these groups will be actually have to keep the forest much more at arm's length, engage in town and city life, maybe engage in agriculture, which entails clearing the forest and this kind of thing.
Let me get Allison, who looks like she's calling us from Malvern, Pennsylvania. And Allison, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Morning.
I love this topic. Thank you.
You're
so
welcome.
Much for having it.
You're welcome.
My question was regarding an elephant conservation group that I follow on Twitter that appears to my eyes to be, you know, one of the better players. It's called the Sheldrick Wildlife Trust. And I was just curious, your guests had an opinion about whether that is a valid conservation group, or if, heaven forbid, I've been, you know, taken in by, you know, something that looks like it's better than it is. Could they speak to that group?
Sure.
Or other groups?
Yeah, I'm going to toss that to you, Andrew Dobson. I've heard of that organization as well. Do you feel comfortable weighing in on that?
No, the Sheldrake Wildlife Trust does a fabulous job. I mean, it's a tragedy that it has to exist in the first place because it's there as an orphanage for baby elephants that have been found because they're largely because their parents, their mothers, have been poached or elephants that have lost the land they're living in. So, I mean, the best thing would be we didn't need it, but in terms of rearing baby elephants, looking after them, providing an opportunity for people who go to their orphanage in Nairobi to see baby elephants, it's a good thing. It helps spread the message, but the best possible thing would be if we didn't have a need for it.
Here's a comment from Patricia. She says, I was recently in Tanzania and visited the Victoria Trust, whose goal is to keep animals in the wild and treat the human-related problems in elephant populations. So, I mean, clearly in Africa, Andrew, there are organizations and things in play to address the risk that these elephants face.
Yeah, totally. We need more of them, and they need more money to do the job, often a very good job that they are doing.
Well, I saved the question about zoos for the last. What do you think about elephants in zoos, Andrew?
I think zoos should begin to move beyond having elephants. It's plain that no zoo is going to have big enough areas of land to have elephants in there. That there are many other animals that you can send a very nice message about by having them in captivity. I actually think the Fresno Zoo in California has done a fabulous job of having a large African savanna where they have got a little tent set up that mimics the tent that Charles Foley, who works with the elephants in Tarangire, is. And you can watch films, you can walk into Charles's tent, but it's just telling you about elephants in Tanzania without you having to see elephants, but you have the experience of being there in a tent watching the other animals, the gazelles and other things that they've got in that exhibit. And I think that's a good way to do it. Give people the experience of pretending they're on safari and allowing them to make a donation to important conservation work like that.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Jacob, what are your thoughts about zoos and elephants?
Well, I, again, my instinct is usually to sort of hesitate to criticize, there's people who have been working in zoos with elephants their whole lives, probably doing, again, very heroic work in that setting and probably gaining forms of knowledge that we shouldn't be to rush to dismiss. On the other hand, it certainly is my experience talking to people who work with elephants in the region where I was doing my research, that the elephants need a pretty significant range of mobility in order to be healthy and happy, certainly in order to be happy work partners with humans in those regions. And so the fact that in zoos, even sort of very good expansive zoos, that range of mobility is pretty significantly curtailed, almost by definition, that just seems to me like an inherent problem. So I would tend to agree that some sort of transition away from the zoo model and towards something else should probably be where we head, with the caveat that, one of the really compelling arguments that zoos have made for themselves is that they keep the public, and especially sort of younger members of the public, engaged with the whole question of animals and love of animals and sort of interested in that world and the relevance of that world to their lives. And they're able to do that in a very kind of a sort of present, visceral way, whereas the more kind of like virtual alternatives might not be able to do that as well. So I think maybe that would be my caveat with advocating that they not have any elephants at all.
Well, on that note, we have to end our conversation. Andrew Dobson, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
My pleasure. It's always good to talk with you.
Nice to talk to you as well. And he's a professor of ecology at Princeton University. He studies infectious disease and the conservation of endangered and threatened species. Jacob Schell, thanks for coming in and joining us as well.
Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. Associate professor of geography and urban studies at Temple University. Again, the author of a new book called Giants of the Monsoon Forest, Living and Working with Elephants. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen, with help today from Xavier Lopez. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we close things out with Saint-Saëns, Carnival of the Animals, and this is Leonard Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic 1962.